Coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. Education and how it's funded in the first state is an issue Governor John Carney calls one of his top priorities, with the goal of getting money to where it's needed most.
I've put a focus on additional funding for the schools to really lean into making sure that those children have an equal educational opportunity in our state and are able to be successful.
Governor Carney joins us for an in-depth discussion about education in Delaware. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also examine the support Delaware is receiving for its appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court to preserve the state's judicial balance requirement. And Arts Playlist previews a pop-up art gallery and art competition coming to a Wilmington Bluecoats basketball game next month. It's all next on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. It was just about a month ago now that Governor John Carney delivered his State of the State address and unveiled his budget plan for fiscal year 2021. They helped define the governor's priorities for the coming year in a variety of areas. This week, Governor Carney visited our Delaware Public Media studios to talk a bit more in depth about some of those priorities and other issues. And we plan to bring you that conversation in two parts over the next 2 weeks. This week, we have a singular focus, education, specifically funding for schools in the first state. Let's start with education. You've been visiting schools across the states recently, looking at how opportunity funding is being used on the ground to tackle a variety of issues from assisting low-income and English language learners, mental health supports, behavioral health, pre-K registration. From your perspective, are they having the impact you'd hope they'd have, this funding?
Well, let's first talk about and think about what the objective is. And mm-hmm. we have really three simple objectives. And one of the things I wanted to do and told the people of Delaware I would do if elected governor was to really kind of focus our energies in public education. And we have three big objectives. One is to make sure that every child can read at grade level by grade three. Because you learn to read from preschool to grade three, and then you read to learn the rest of your academic career. So if you're not reading at grade level by third grade, you're going to struggle along the way. And we actually have a long way to go with respect to that. And then secondly, and particularly since math is increasingly important in the world we live in science, and the jobs of the future are going to be based so much in math and science, is to have that middle school math proficiency as well as an objective. And so we've got math coaches and a focus on that. And what's interesting to me is I ask the children all the time, what's their favorite subject? And so many kids today will say math, which I think is not the way it's always been.
Mm-hmm.
But that makes me feel good. And then lastly, our third big objective is to make sure every student graduates from high school either ready to go into the workforce productively, and we have a pathways program that has grown. It's something that Governor Markell started, has really been quite effective and quite necessary, or graduate ready to go into higher education at Delaware State University, University of Delaware, Delaware Tech, Wesley College, or wherever they might go. And they're ready to go mm-hmm. and they're proficient to go, and they don't need remedial
right.
classes. We hear a lot about that from each of our higher ed. So if you think about those as the overall objectives, and then you ask yourself, how are we doing?
Mm-hmm.
You find out we're doing okay with some student populations, but not nearly as well with particularly children that come from disadvantaged backgrounds and English learners. And so I've put a focus on additional funding for the schools, the principals and teachers, to really lean into making sure that those children have an equal educational opportunity in our state and are able to be successful. And that's where opportunity funding comes into it. So it's a big priority for me and for us as a state. I've been very pleased with what I'm seeing. Every district, every school, every principal has a little bit different approach to it, and it meets the needs, I think, of those student populations. And but we'll have to see. I mean, one of the things that was important with the whole effort was to create a committee to evaluate the programs and make sure that they're actually having some impact.
Is that, I guess, the big question going forward then? Is this opportunity funding going to go far enough in terms of not just the amount but also in terms of the permanence of what it produces? I guess in short, is this just maybe the start of what needs to be done to deliver long-term education funding solution for schools across the state?
Well, it's certainly the start of new resources to achieve that objective, for sure. We don't have that to date, although principals and superintendents can use their local money and state, you know, their state resources. We're not an underfunded education system in Delaware. We rank pretty highly among states in terms of the per student funding for those for education. But we do not target resources specifically other than federal Title I monies for our disadvantaged students. So it is the start in that respect. Teachers and principals have been working on it over the years, but this is a start of adding additional resources specifically for those populations. I think the key is to really focus on what works.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why the evaluation subcommittee is so important, to look at what's working across our state.
I do want to ask, I mean, there is a possibility that the future of funding education in the state is something that could be imposed upon the state by the courts. There's two lawsuits right now revolving around funding inequity and then property tax assessments at the county level and how they impact funding. How much do those looming cases factor in your administration's thinking about what's next for funding beyond opportunity funding in Delaware?
Yeah, it doesn't factor into my thinking at all, frankly. You know, I thought about what we needed. I've been thinking about what we need to do in public education for the last 20 years after being elected lieutenant governor in the year 2000. And we did. We really focused in those days. That was just when the accountability standards were having a real impact. And we decided to take a look at the schools that were successful, and we created a program that we called Models of Excellence in Education. So it was really looking at just what we're talking about,
mm-hmm.
different programs and districts and schools that seemed to have it working, and in particular looking at the proficiency achievement levels for low-income students, minority students, because we know and we hear all the time about the achievement gap or the opportunity gap, mm-hmm. as I like to call it, which is where the opportunity funding language comes from. And so for me, that was always the focus. We have, as I said, so when I ran for office, I talked a lot about simplifying things. Let's not change the test again. Let's not change the standards again. Let's really hunker down and figure out how do we get every student where they needed to be, third grade reading, middle school math, and high school graduation. And so we're really leaning into that. With respect to the case itself, you know, the court will make its decision on the issues that are before the court. As I said, if you look at the spending, and we have to look per student now by virtue of the new federal legislation, you'll see that we significant mm-hmm. amount of resources goes to the students that we're talking about. So we'll see how the judge looks at that.
Is there a sense, though, that there may be a need for further deeper conversation, not just over the issues we've talked about before, but also, you know, we've talked about growing enrollment at schools and growing special needs enrollment, yeah, which also puts some pressure on the education funding system as well, right?
Absolutely. And it's something that very few people really know about. And I learned just becoming governor 2 years ago, we had 208 new units. That means we had however many students make up a unit, 15 students per unit or something like that. But 200 of those units were special ed units, to your point, which means the student population in special ed units is growing much faster than the rate of regular education students. And so what happens is you get more resources for those special education students. Then the more complex their needs, the more revenue you get. If it's an autistic child or right. a child with severe learning challenges. And so as a state, so back to your question about resources, you know, we struggle to keep up with just new students coming in, and particularly students, high need students, to meet their obligations. This year, in a budget that we just presented to the General Assembly, the number associated with just the new students mm-hmm. projected for last year was $40 million.
Right.
That's a pretty big number.
Yeah.
So when you add that into what we're doing, we're talking about significant resources just to keep up with the student population. And a lot of that, as you say accurately, is because of larger percentages of students with special needs.
You mentioned earlier the local funding piece of it. And I'm curious, I mean, there have been some other ideas floated in the legislature about that piece of it, specifically surrounding the referendum process. And it seems in recent years, almost every district that goes to referendum fails at least once before it ultimately maybe succeeds. And there has been discussion about allowing districts to raise taxes a small amount without referendum on the operating side. Is something like this something that should be more seriously considered to kind of help in this kind of puzzle that you're putting together for funding to take some pressure off the districts and having them to put a lot of resources and energy into basically having the campaign to get the money they need?
Yeah, as you well know, Tom, it's been an issue that's been talked about for years and years and years,
yeah.
as long as almost as I've been in public service, and there's just not a lot of support out there for mm-hmm. doing away with referendum, not surprisingly, not much support for taking away from people the ability to vote on whatever the public policy issue might be. That's kind of the way a democracy works. So going back to our focus, which is on opportunity funding, our objective will be to, in some ways, replace what would otherwise be covered by local property taxes with state funding, and that's the approach that we're taking, as opposed to trying to figure out a different way to do referenda for local operating budgets. And I would observe, as you probably know, that capital referendum are much more successful because
right.
it's something that people can look
it's
at.
It's tangible.
And,
right.
It's tangible. And it shows your physically the commitment. And we have brand new school. We have brand new high school. Dover and Bridgeville and
Indian River just got there.
Indian River, another one. And frankly, the two high schools they had were pretty new. And
you know,
when you think about it, but it's much more difficult on the operating side. And so our focus on opportunity funding and meeting the needs of students with special needs, I do think we have to look at in the long term. And this is something that I wanted to combine internally at anyway. With opportunity funding and the evaluation of it after the three initial years, is Division III, which is equalization funding, which, as you know, goes towards the poorer school district property tax value wide. So, districts like Lake Forest and Woodbridge and mm-hmm. Laurel and districts like that. Now, everybody gets money out of Division III,
right.
and that's a big. It's almost $100 million.
Right.
You compare it to the $20, $25 million of opportunity funding gives you an idea of the scale.
Right.
And I think that's an area that we can take a look at because it doesn't – there is a component in there that relates to local effort in terms of the property tax rate. I think everybody currently meets that effort. Mm-hmm. But you get more state resources as a result of that, and that can be a mechanism to address the issue you've been talking about.
I bring up the referendum in part because Christina School District has now set a date for its next referendum in June. It has struggled mightily to pass their referendum in recent years and for now is home to Wilmington Schools, which you have sought to help in this particular budget that you presented with capital funding for one new school and renovating two other buildings. Is there a worry that capital spending plan isn't as effective if the district running those schools is in a funding crunch because they can't pass a referendum?
Oh, absolutely. And the reason that my proposal is for the state to pay the full amount for those school renovations and upgrades is because there's some uncertainty about what district those
schools will be.
Right,
the Reading Consortium is working for that now.
Because of the Reading Consortium and the work that they're doing. Important work for sure. And by the way, under Governor Markell, with the commission that was set up there, the so-called
sure.
WEA Commission, recommended that those schools no longer be part of the Christina School District, that they go over to Red Clay. It wasn't ultimately approved, but the point is that there's a big question mark around where those schools should go. Should Christina, which is not adjacent to the city of
right.
Wilmington, should they still be part of that mix? And Reading Commission is going to look at those important questions. From my perspective, there are children in those schools every day, and we need to make sure that they're getting the best education that they can. And that's why we developed the Memorandum of Understanding to assist the district, since we don't at the state level have the kind of actual authority or control there in meeting those student needs. And it has to start with buildings that are up to date. The buildings are in terrible condition. Mm-hmm. You know, we can discuss or argue whose responsibility that is, but we have a responsibility to make sure that children get what they deserve, and then Reading will determine, you know,
where it all falls out
in the end. And you won't be able to say, as was said before, well, by Red Clay, well, we don't want those buildings
because we're going to have to fix them.
We're going to have to fix them, and that's a fair argument.
One final question on education. We saw a Christina board member censured recently for comments suggesting the best thing for some children growing up in high poverty areas would be to remove them from their families as infants and return them when they've graduated high school. At the same time, Odyssey Charter under fire for a board member commenting jokingly, suggesting it build a wall between itself and the dual language charter school neighbor it has and actually rents the space to. How much, in your opinion, do situations like these involving school leadership hinder efforts to improve schools in this state, especially in places like Wilmington? And is there any role the state can play in making this conversation a better conversation?
Yeah, I think it does hurt our efforts to address the real needs of these students and the populations. And I think what was said in both cases are, you know, we're unfortunate and insensitive, particularly to the children and the families that were alluded to in both sets of comments. And yes, the state can, and state leaders like myself can make a difference. You know, from day one, I have said that the children in the city of Wilmington and poor children across our state, in Dover and Seaford and Laurel and Milton and Milford, no matter where it is, are just as important. And they're not, you know, and they're not achieving the levels that we need them to be successful in life. And so we need to do a better job there. So yes, there is a moral voice that comes along with the authority of these offices that we hold as a privilege to serve the people of our state, and we should provide the leadership. Sometimes with the frustration of the moment, the frustration of not being able to figure out how to help children. I don't question most people's motives. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know the people as well involved with the Odyssey situation. We have worked with Mr. Pulaski on the Christina School Board. I know that he cares about the children. It was unfortunate what he said. But we need to be more thoughtful about how we're stereotyping children and families, and more thoughtful about saying we have a public obligation to help make sure those children are successful. We're going to be a better state for it. Every individual is going to be better for it. It's in all of our interest. If you need to look at it that way, we have an obligation to those students, and we have an obligation as elected officials to be leaders and to express, you know, kind of a moral authority there.
Thanks to Governor John Carney for joining us on The Green this week. We'll have the second half of our conversation with Governor Carney next week here on The Green. And this week's edition of The Green continues in just a moment with more analysis of the case involving Delaware's judicial balance requirement that will be heard next month in the U.S. Supreme Court. That's next here on The Green on Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Late last year, the U.S. Supreme Court agreed to review lower court decisions striking down Delaware's judicial balance requirement. It's the only case the justices decided to add to their spring docket. Now we have a date for oral arguments before the justices. That's going to be next month on March 25th. As we've previously discussed, Delaware's Constitution calls for its Supreme Court, Chancery Court, and Superior Court to be split almost evenly between the two major political parties. But a U.S. district court judge and a federal appeals court ruled that provision unconstitutional after Delaware lawyer James Adams, an independent, challenged it in 2017, arguing it essentially freezes him as an independent out of consideration for seats on the bench. In the run-up to the Supreme Court hearing arguments next month, a number of people and groups have filed amicus or friend of the court briefs, exclusively backing the state's argument the lower court decision should be reversed. Back in December, we sat down with Widener University Delaware Law School constitutional law professor Alan Garfield to talk about this case and what's at stake. This week, he rejoins us to discuss these briefs and the potential impact they could have. One note before we start, Garfield joined a group of law professors signing on to one of the briefs filed, written by Widener Delaware Law School Dean Rod Smola, offering support for Delaware's legal argument in this case. So the briefs that were submitted to the Supreme Court overwhelmingly support Delaware's position that the lower court ruling should be reversed. Was there a common theme to their arguments in support, or one of the three questions that the court was asking be considered that they focused on maybe more so than others?
I think, like you said, there were 12 amicus briefs. 11 of those supported Delaware's position, and the one brief that didn't was neutral. It didn't support either parties, but its argument also supported Delaware's position. So all of them came out in favor of Delaware's position. And I think if there was a universal theme, it was that, you know what? This system has worked wonderfully well. The Delaware has this highly respected judiciary. You know, we don't think the court should mess with something that has served both Delaware and the country so well. And the implications of messing with the Delaware system could have negative implications for various federal agencies, for a multitude of state and local governmental bodies that also have a balanced, you know, balanced rules for having, you know, people from both parties on them. So I think that was the common theme. Don't mess with something that has worked so well.
You mentioned that one brief that was kind of an outlier because it was a more neutral brief. Looking at that brief or the other ones, were there any kind of maybe different perspectives or arguments that wound up supporting Delaware or questioning kind of the state's ability to maintain this judicial balance provision?
You know, I think each brief brings its own special perspective and adds something. So if you think about it, one brief came from former chief justices of the Delaware Supreme Court, including Leo Strine, who had just stepped down from the court in time to join that brief. And, you know, it says something when you have justices who have been associated with different political parties and have that experience of having been on the court, that from their perspective, they can say, we have seen how well this system works. So they could speak from that perspective. Likewise, there was a brief from former Delaware governors, and they've got the experience of speaking about what it's like, the system of appointing people to the Delaware highest courts. And they, too, were from the two different major political parties in the case. And they were able to speak to, again, how this forces, you know, governors to find candidates who, you know, who are the best qualified people and who are not hyper-partisan, and also to say that they have seen from their experience, you know, how well this has served Delaware. Also, I think important contributions that came here is there was one brief from the state and local government associations. This was a variety of organizations, the National Conference of State Legislatures, the National Association of Counties, the National League of Cities, the U.S. Conference of Mayors, and all of them, their perspective was, we're not just focused on Delaware. We're focused on what this decision could do for us because they said there are hundreds of state and local governments that have made thoughtful decisions to use bipartisan decision-making processes in the governmental entities they create. And they started talking about judicial selection committees, election boards, ethics committees, redistricting committees, commissions, audit commissions. And they said, if this decision goes the wrong way, it could potentially implicate and undermine all of these entities, which we think have served us well, specifically because of their bipartisan nature. So they had that unique perspective. Another, I think, brief that was of important significance was from the United States Chamber of Commerce. And that, the Supreme Court gets lots of amicus briefs, and there are some organizations who I think get greater attention from the court than others because of the significance of their organization, because of the strength of their briefs. The Supreme Court's doing a civil liberties case, and it sees a brief from the ACLU. It's going to take it seriously. And the U.S. Chamber of Commerce is also, it has one of the strongest records of having its briefs cited by the court. And so when it weighs in, I think it's important. And it, you know, had the perspective of saying, look, we are the world's largest business federation. We represent approximately 300,000, you know, members of companies of a wide variety of sizes. And we know from our experience that Delaware courts are the crown jewel of the state court judiciaries, and that companies of all sizes across every industry have benefited from the quality and the efficiency of the Delaware legal system. So they're stepping in and they're saying, hey, we're customers of this Delaware judicial system, and we're telling the Supreme Court, this has worked well, and if you strike this down, it could have terrible negative implications for all of the companies that have been relying on the stability of Delaware corporate law and the Delaware judiciary.
Having said that, considering you have those particular players, mm-hmm. and it's one-sided in favor of Delaware, how much does that really make an impact on the court? I mean, is this likely to have a real impact on the way the court views this case and rules on this case?
Well, I mean, I think the justices on the United States Supreme Court, like the justices on the Delaware Supreme Court, are independent thinkers. And I don't think ultimately the balance between amicus briefs on one side or the other are going to be decisive for them. They have their ideas of how the Constitution should be interpreted, what policies they are trying to further. So I think, you know, they're independent enough that they're going to decide this case the way they think it should be decided. Having said that, you know, I think they know all too well, particularly having seen the recent, you know, scorched earth battles over replacements on their own court with Merrick Garland, with Gorsuch, and with Kavanaugh, to probably have a lot of appreciation for Delaware's way of doing things. So my guess is they would be sympathetic anyway to Delaware's position. My guess is they would probably agree with the position of a lot of these briefs that the way the Third Circuit interpreted the court's First Amendment jurisprudence was not really consonant with what those cases are about. So I think they'll be sympathetic, but I don't think that just because the briefs are lopsided in one way. I mean, you could have some cases where there's just a lot of wealthy, interested parties who could afford to hire lawyers to put in lots of briefs, and I don't know if that's going to make it, you know, decide it that way just by counting, you know, the noses of how many briefs came on one side instead of another.
I also found it interesting that sometimes these situations create kind of strange bedfellows. And in this case, one of the briefs that was in there was from the National Republican Committee, which would seem to be kind of a strange one, supporting a Democratic governor. And you know, I guess in some ways that you do see that when these situations come up, that oftentimes parties that would normally maybe be at odds come together.
Well, I do think when you look through the briefs, you find, as I said, with, you know, like the governors, the former governors of Delaware, that you're getting people on from both major political parties supporting this. And, you know, both of them realizing the benefits of having a bipartisan, you know, court. And mind you, you talked about the Republican National Committee. Well, if Republicans are more likely than not to be the odd party out in Delaware, it's to their advantage to have a provision like this. Otherwise, all of the appointments would be Democrats. So they're actually benefiting from this. But I also think they realize, you know, there's even besides that, there's just merit to this kind of system.
Anything else as you were looking through these briefs kind of pique your interest as standing out?
Yes. I think there was one interesting brief that was from two professors, a professor, Brian Feinstein from Wharton, and David Hemmel from the University of Chicago Law School. And these are scholars who do empirical work, and they study empirical work. And without having their focus on the Delaware court, you know, they have seen from their empirical studies that, you know, decision-making bodies that have a balance between people from both parties tend to produce, you know, less polarized decision-making, tend to avoid these kind of opportunistic appointment practices, and in generally, I think, believe that they produce better, fairer, decision making, and in fact, you know, the Delaware State Bar Association put in a brief, and they said, you know, it's so often now when you see a decision coming out of a federal judicial court, the media account is going to say, and this was by this judge who was appointed by this president. It's like, oh, this is a Trump judge, this is an Obama judge, and they said, you know what, that doesn't happen with decisions that come out of the Delaware court. And in fact, you know, for better or for worse, there is a lot of empirical evidence which has shown that, you know, based on taking federal court of appeals, these three-judge panels, that how the decisions come out on many different issues are affected by, are there two Republicans and one Democrat? Are there two Democrats and one Republican? And I think that, you know, the point is that, as these two professors were saying, there's empirical evidence to suggest the Delaware way actually has a lot of good benefits for producing healthy decision making. So I thought that brief was also a notable brief. And you talked about, on the one hand, the Republican National Committee supporting Delaware, and the Brennan Center Brennan Center for Justice at NYU School of Law, which is a nonpartisan public policy institute. I usually think a lot of their positions tend to support more liberal positions personally, but I mean, they too came out in favor of this system. You know, they're concerned about creating a democracy that works well and where the rule of law works well. And their sense that they look at Delaware's novel approach, and they comment about how highly successful this has been, and that it's important for the Supreme Court in our federal system to show deference to this experimentation that's being done in the different states. I mean, that is a real strong value that the court has always spoke of, that the states are laboratories for experimentation. And this has been a pretty darn good experiment in Delaware, something other states probably could learn from. I mean, the briefs also made the point that the Third Circuit is suggesting, you know, oh, you're not supposed to be considering a person's political affiliation in making these appointments. That's in conflict with the Supreme Court jurisprudence. And you know, some of the briefs made the point that, you know, what are you talking about? You know, what you think when they appoint people to the United States Supreme Court and federal courts that the president, Trump, is not thinking about the party affiliation? You think the Senate, when they're doing confirmation, I mean, it's totally partisan. You think in Pennsylvania, where they elect judges, you know, people aren't thinking about, is this a Democratic candidate or Republican candidate? I mean, people's political affiliations have always been considered. The point is, and Delaware's point is, it might make sense at the time of appointment to do it to help get this partisan balance that serves people well. What the Third Circuit got tripped up on is thinking that, you know, this exception to the rule should only be people who, after their appointment, need to show loyalty, fealty to the person who appointed them. Well, that makes sense for the president's cabinet or something. The president needs people who are loyal, and he could choose people from his party if he wants. But that's not the only reason why party affiliation could be relevant. It could also be relevant in all these independent commissions where you want to keep them balanced. And the Delaware Supreme Court's an example.
Thanks to Widener University Delaware Law School constitutional law professor Alan Garfield for his time on The Green this week. And stay with us. Arts Playlist is next, where we'll learn about an effort to highlight local artists at an upcoming Wilmington Bluecoats basketball game. That's on the way next, here on The Green, on Delaware Public Media. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. Art and basketball might seem like an odd pairing, but the two team up next month in Wilmington. The Philadelphia 76ers NBA G League affiliate, the Delaware Bluecoats, and the Sold Firm host a pop-up art gallery and basketball-themed art competition featuring local visual artists Saturday, March 21st at the 76ers Fieldhouse. It's during the Bluecoats contest with the Fort Wayne Mad Ants. That night is also Mental Health Awareness Night at the Bluecoats. In this week's Arts Playlist, Bluecoats president Larry Melai and the Sold Firm's owner, Nataki Oliver, talked to Delaware Public Media's Kelly Steele about this event and how it'll be used to highlight local artists.
Larry, tell me all about Art Madness.
Absolutely. So we tried to be more than just a basketball team, a basketball game, try to find unique ways to engage our fans that come to the game. And we partnered with the Sold Firm, which is, you know, this local gallery here in Wilmington, and they showcase kind of emerging artists, and kind of thought of this idea to do almost like an art show at our game. But how can we be different with it and using the power of basketball to kind of bring people together? So we talked with them, and we came up with this event called Art Madness that'll be at our game. And you know, it should be a pretty cool event for all our fans.
Has the Delaware Bluecoats ever done anything like this before? I mean, when you think of art, you think of art. When you think of basketball, you think of basketball. You don't normally pair the two together. Have you guys ever done anything like this before?
We haven't. And I, you know, honestly, I'm giving credit to the 76ers with their crossover platform. They just done a kind of an art exhibit in Philadelphia. So to kind of steal a little bit from them, we wanted to find a way to intersect basketball and different aspects of our culture, whether it's art, food, music, theater. And this time we're gonna jump into the art side of it. And that was kind of the genesis from it all.
Now, this Art Madness, this pop-up art gallery and basketball-themed art competition will be on display during the Bluecoats tip-off with the Fort Wayne Mad Ants on Saturday, March 21st. Do you expect a larger-than-normal crowd at this game because of this Art Madness?
Absolutely. We're going to sell this game out. We're also partnering with the state of Delaware on a mental health awareness night that same night. So I think we'll have a packed house. It'll be a lot of fun. There'll be a live painting, art demos, a lot of things for our fans to take in that evening. So it should be really a fun game for everyone.
Larry, tell me more about this mental health awareness night.
So we partnered with Lieutenant Governor Bethany Hall Long. Her main platform is on mental health awareness and providing resources for those that are struggling in all aspects of mental health, whether it's addiction or what have you. And they reached out to us and we were like, look, why don't we use the power of basketball, our platform, our stage, to raise awareness, raise some money, and really make it a big night that we can talk about mental health in this community.
What do you expect from team members themselves, Blue Coats team members, on the night of Art Madness? Are any of the team members artists?
Right now we are surveying them to make sure that they can be engaged if that is a passion of theirs. There isn't anyone, I think, on the team right now that is, but it doesn't mean that you can't. You can't start. You can always start somewhere, and we're going to certainly try to get them involved as well.
Anything else about Art Madness or about the Delaware Bluecoats that you want to get out to the general public?
I guess the important thing is that we try to use the basketball. It's such a beautiful sport, and it is our main product. It's our center ring, if you will. But I think it's important for people to know that, we can use the power of basketball to really drive positive change in this community. And we're going to use our game as kind of that stage for not only bringing people together, but giving them an outlet, and use the field house as kind of that beacon, for kids that might need some help, that might need an outlet, that type of thing. So I think it's important to realize that we're more than just a basketball team. We are a community-based organization.
All right, Nataki Oliver is the owner of the Sold Firm. Nataki, tell me about the Sold Firm's position in this Art Madness.
The Sold Firm is a gallery downtown Wilmington, which has a good relationship with several businesses in the city, and one of them has been the 76ers Arena and the Blue Coats. So we decided that because of the contributions that the art has given to the city of Wilmington, we decided that it would be a great opportunity to combine basketball and art in one night at the arena with a art pop-up gallery, which we've done throughout the city before. So we just wanted to merge two great things that the city of Wilmington has embraced and the community's love. Leading up to that, we're going to have a couple other events that the city and the communities can participate in March as well. So we, instead of making it March Madness, which everybody's familiar with in the basketball world, we decided to flip it and make it Art Madness.
That's so great. This is going to be a great event. Why basketball and art? How do they go together? How do you make them go together?
So because I have a background in art and I research it heavily, and the trends that are happening, I've noticed in the last about 10 years, the basketball community and the NBA has really embraced the art culture, from it being fashion to them actually bringing emerging artists to the forefront. Like, we know a lot of the major artists that have paved the way throughout the years. And so emerging artists have had a struggle in years becoming relevant. And we have to admit that social media and Instagram has really made that possible. So I've noticed that a lot of the NBA teams and a lot of the stars have really made artists popular by embracing the art culture. They may not have noticed it before, but it's now happened. And I feel that in Wilmington, with us having our own basketball team, the NBA G League, the Delaware Blue Coats, it would be perfect to now have us merge the two when other big cities are actually doing it.
Now, are you looking for artists for this pop-up art gallery and basketball-themed art competition?
Yes. So in 2019, I actually manage artists through the gallery. But one of the components, I noticed a lot of artists were coming to me and they wanted me to manage them, and I cannot physically do everything on my own. So I created the SoCo Art Collective, which is artists can come together at pop-up, sell their artwork, sell their merchandise in one space where art lovers can come at one time and check out all the emerging artists in Wilmington who are participating. So right now for the event, we are looking for vendors, artists, you know, artists who would like to vend. We're looking for even art galleries who have a collection of archives that they would like to share of multiple artists, and creatives who, you know, may make apparel, but they make it by hand and they have a visual art component to it. So, yes, we are. And the deadline for the vending, for vendors to reserve a space, is March 8th.
Do you expect a lot of artists to step up to the plate and get involved in this? Two-part question. The second half, do you expect artists from out of Delaware to come in and participate?
Absolutely. In 2019, we held 4 to 5 so-called art pop-ups. And there's usually 15 to 20 artists who participate. Last fall, we had a two-day session, which was one day at Deco, and the other day, the second day was at the Constitution Arena, Constitution Yard, down at the riverfront. And it was an explosion. It's something new, and it's something that I feel should grow, and I see it happening. And I would love to have artists outside of Delaware to participate, because we always go outside of Delaware into other states to participate in their art culture.
We've been talking to Nataki Oliver. She founded the Sold Firm back in 2018. Nataki, give us a shameless plug all about the Sold Firm. What are you guys all about?
So I started the Sold Firm very organically. I've always been, like I said, in the arts and in fashion. So coming back to Delaware from New York, I knew that I wanted to bring what I've learned and what I've experienced back to Wilmington. And about 2-3 years ago, I worked with an artist who just was looking for advice and actually wanted me to curate his first art show. I did that. From that, other artists began to reach out to me and look for the same presence and the same assistance. From that, I was able to then manage an artist and manage a couple of artists here in Wilmington to help their career. When it started to grow, I knew that I needed an art gallery space, which is the Sold Firm at 800 B North Tatnall Street. And I opened the art gallery. It's been about a year. It's been about a year now. And since then, I've held countless exhibits, art shows. I've had, in addition to that, I've been able to have a youth component, which is So Youth Paint Sessions. It's a creative expression sessions that we have with City of Wilmington Youth at different locations. So I've had it at the Sold Firm. I've then been able to branch out and have it at West End, which we're going to have one in March also. So the Sold Firm is really a hub for artists to become, nobody knowing who you are, to become an emerging artist, to then get the confidence to expand out of Wilmington into other states, but still understand that this is your home base, and we want the art culture to grow. I feel in the next 5 years, that's my goal. My goal is to push the arts as much in Wilmington in the next 5 years so that we can compete on a level of Philadelphia, the New Yorks, and the Californians, and even the Miamis, so that people can look at us and say, hey, they have a lot of amazing artists here, which we do, but they don't have the confidence or the place to start. So that's what the Sold Firm is.
Thanks to Bluecoats President Larry Melei, the Sold Firm's owner, Nataki Oliver, and our Kelly Steele for joining us on this edition of Arts Playlist. Tickets for the Bluecoats game and the art show March 21st are available at Sixers.com/Bluecoats. And that's all for this week's edition of The Green. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. And remember, you can also check out The Green via podcast at our website, on Apple Podcasts, and on the NPR One app. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page, on Twitter, at TheGreenDE, or by emailing us at TheGreen@DelawarePublic.org. Thanks to those who helped make today's show possible, including Delaware Public Media's Kelly Steele. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Burns saying Thanks for joining us this week. And we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground.